Hi, folks, and thanks for listening to this podcast. Couple of things, just two quick short things. Please make May the month you join the Tortoise Shack. Go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Try it out for a month. There's no long-term contract. You can cancel at the end of the month. But I promise you, you'll find lots of extra content there, lots of other podcasts that you didn't even know we were associated with. And you'll be part of a lovely community of activists who care, people who want to change things and make this a better country and indeed a better world, if that's not too highfalutin. And the second thing is, and I'm also delighted to share with you this following message from our friend Zach Hanaya, who was successfully evacuated from Gaza and is now in Cairo and will be reunited with his family in the coming days. So as I said, two things. Click the link. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And please listen to the compassion and love in the voice of our friend Zach Hanaya. I hope to see you soon, pal.
I don't know how to thank all my friends, all the Irish people, that really I don't have words to thank them, because they showed me what the humanity means. I'm really touched by their limitless kindness and mercy and the humanity. All the people, all my dear friends in Ireland, they offering everything to help, and they showing solidarity and love. That's what we need. We need the humanity. We need to feel as human beings, and we need to feel that the world, everybody in this world is brothers and sisters. We need to live in peace. We need to live, to have love for each other in this planet. That's what we need. That's what we need in Gaza now. Everybody in Gaza need a hug, because everybody is broken. Our life is broken. Our hearts is broken.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Palcast, a podcast brought to you by Yusuf Al-Jabal here in Istanbul, Helena Coban, who's joining us from Washington, D.C., and Tony Groves, who's joining us from Dublin, Ireland. Helena is the president of Just Word Educational, and Tony is a producer with the Tortoise Shack podcast. He has been producing Palcast for over 4 months now. It's April 30 here in Istanbul, and for the benefits of our listeners, it's 6 p.m. here, and we are very delighted today to be joined by Zarifa Barood from Seattle in the United States. Zarifa, very good to have you.
Oh, it's so good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. So Zarifa is a PhD candidate at the University of Exeter at the European Center for Palestine Studies. She received her master's degree in policy studies from the University of Washington, where she researched American aid programs to the Israeli military, which is very relevant today. She currently works as a digital media associate for the American Muslims for Palestine. Zarifa, I would like to ask you first to tell us more about your connections to Gaza. And I know that you have a family in Gaza. Your father, Dr. Ramzi, is a dear friend of mine and a neighbor. I know a lot about your family, but I want you to tell us more about your family and your connection to Gaza before we start talking politics.
Sure. Next month we're going to be commemorating the 76th anniversary of the Nakba. And so it's super relevant to talk about this connection. My family is originally from a village called Beit Taras, now in quote unquote Israel proper, kind of close to Tel Aviv. It's just a few miles north of the current Gaza border. And in 1948, my family was expelled, including my grandfather, Mohammed, and my grandma, Zarifa, who I was named after. and they were found refuge in the Brej and Nusayrat camps. And that is where my dad was born and raised. It took me, 23 years to be able to go visit. And that was in 2022. So that was a really incredible experience. But yeah, as you mentioned, I still have a great deal of family there and so many dear friends as well.
Thank you for this introduction and very important connection to Gaza. You mentioned your visit to Gaza in 2022, and you met a very special person then named Rifat al-Ar'ir, who later became very famous globally for a poem he wrote titled If I Must Die. And a reminder to our listeners, Helena is the publisher of Rifat's both books, Gaza and Silence and Gaza Rise Back. Could you please tell us more about your memories with Rifat and young people in Gaza, and overall like memories of, I saw pictures of you enjoying the golden sands of Gaza's beach.
Yeah, that was on my first day, my cousin Yazan took me to the beach, and it was such an amazing experience. Because it was all those pictures that, you know, for over two decades of my life, my dad's been telling me the stories about growing up there and the Fridays, the Jumu'ah that they'd spend on the beach. And so it was really amazing to see it for myself and kind of put a visual to all of those stories. I thought I met him. I was invited to speak and do a workshop for the amazing students with We Are Not Numbers in Gaza, where I spoke about advocacy in the U.S. and things of that nature. And it was such an amazing experience. I met so many bright students who I'm still connected with today. And that was where I was able to have the honor of meeting him. I remember we, with a group of people, including Isam Adwan, we went and explored in the old city of Gaza and went and got Mana'ish and talked about, and it was interesting because, I mean, I've been studying Gaza and Palestine for my doctorate and did so in my master's as well. But hearing the Palestinian political perspectives from on the ground, it was super insightful. And I really learned a lot from him. I'm only regretful that I didn't get to spend...
Just by coincidence, I was talking to Isam, I think 2 days ago, about his own situation at the moment, which is improved, and, you know, I'm sure that'll more devolve over time, but he was also, it's funny, Rifat seemed to know everybody everywhere, you know, it's single thread you pull at, the man had just... connections to every single aspect of it, like, and it's gas. That was the name you use, and you know, I'm sitting here in Dublin, you're sitting in Seattle, and we both have other people in common because of the influence and the power of Rifat al-Ar'ir, which is an amazing thing to think about sometimes, you know.
Yeah,
and I'd like to say that it's not just that Rifat became famous with, like, at the time of his killing and at the time of the Israeli genocide, but he became famous back in 2014 when he and you, Yusuf, and Rowan Yeri toured around the United States. And people here in the United States had never knowingly met a person from Gaza before. And the three of you were just such wonderful interlocutors and representatives for your people. And I mean, people all around the United States just felt connected to Gaza in a really rich and deep way because of the three of you led by Rifat. So yeah, it goes on and on. And now the connections between the students here in the United States and the homeless people, the dislocated, relocated, multiply moved people in the tents in Gaza, who are putting up notices saying, you know, thank you, American universities. I mean, to me, it's very moving to see those connections.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think he was really kind of an angel that somehow was able to touch so many lives. And that's still, like, in my mind how I view him and understand him. And I think maybe it's a coping mechanism because that's kind of what happens when you don't get to say goodbye to people. But yeah, I think something that was kind of really kind of a otherworldly experience for me was that I traveled across the whole world to meet him, or not to meet him, but I met him on my travels. And I come back to my small town here, and every protest, there are kites with his poem on them. And I think that's just been a really, yeah, insane experience.
The student protest that Helena touched on, we see the ugly scenes of, you know, heavily armed police. We see the heartwarming scenes of members of the Jewish community and the Muslim community uniting. What is your overall take of the last few days? Because, you know, it is actually something that gives, you know, has historical precedent for bringing about change. But what's your take on it as someone who's seen it and then having to view it through the prism of US media?
Right. I mean, I've not only been involved in community organizing and activism for Palestine for, you know, my young life, but I also have the stories and experiences of both of my parents that were some of the core organizers in the Seattle area when my dad first arrived here. And they were maybe like three Palestinians in Seattle at the time. There was no community. There was no foundation for organizing. There was only kind of the fear and the repercussions that really left a mark. There wasn't solidarity. There wasn't community. There wasn't any of those things. And so seeing that evolution within my lifetime, it's kind of, I feel almost as if its history is being sped up in a way. And it's a very hopeful thing. These students are so incredibly brave. And as a Gaza and as a Palestinian American, it's absolutely moving. And it really feels kind of just like it changes my own perspective on the world as it's being changed by the genocide that we're witnessing, and my loss in hope for humanity is kind of constantly happening over these last 6 months. It's being repaired by these students, and they don't even know that they're doing that.
You are absolutely right. I even saw messages coming out of Gaza and people in, you know, in the tents. We've seen some of these messages. Thank you, American universities. I think there is a sense of hope in Gaza and among displaced Palestinians that something like some sort of pressure is building up in the U.S. and it will finally bring about positive change for Palestinians. We know change is very slow and we might not live to see it. But we see it happening, and I think with the spread of Rifat's poem, I've seen how like one person was able to change the hearts and minds of millions of people. His poem translated into many languages, as you said. You see his poetry and his words flown on kites all over the world. And this is a message of hope, and this is what we need as Palestinians in Gaza today. We have so much destruction, and I want you to talk more about how the genocide in Gaza impacted your own family. We know that almost every single family in Gaza suffered losses. Their homes, their, you know, beloved ones were killed or went missing. Could you please share with us what happened to your own family?
Yeah, so actually the first loss that I experienced in this war was a friend that I made with We Are Not Numbers, Yusuf Thawas. And it's been really great seeing kind of his story also kind of go viral and go everywhere, because I wish that he was alive to see it. But in regards to my own personal family, I mean, we've suffered tens of losses. At this point, we don't know the exact number because a lot of people are just missing at this point. Sorry, is my internet okay? Yeah. I mean, when I was in Gaza, I visited so many family members, and it was me meeting them for the first time. I think a lot of our losses have come from our family in the Shati camp. And that was such an incredible memory for me being there and meeting them all. It was, you know, despite living in a refugee camp and the house was partially damaged because of past Israeli assaults, it was just the most warm and loving and generous family you can imagine. I felt like I had never, I'd never lived in Seattle, but I had always been in Gaza and I've always had that connection with them. And it was also my first time meeting family that really looked like my twins. So that was a really fun experience. But unfortunately, a lot of them, including my cousin Ala, who particularly looked like me, she was just around my age, her and her husband and her 10-year-old son were killed. I think that was probably in, oh gosh, earlier on, like maybe November, December. Kind of all a blur at this point. And then my uncle, Ihab, from that same family was then killed. And then my uncle, Nasser, was then killed. So it's, I have all of these family or pictures that I took, like group photos from those days with them. And I'm the only one alive in some of those pictures.
Devastating. Thank you for sharing that, and I'm really sorry to hear that. And obviously, none of us can understand. I absolutely can't contemplate the amount of loss. But you did speak of hope, and we want to kind of use this podcast to talk about the diaspora and the power of the movement to liberate Palestine. Can I ask, is there in the digital work that you're doing, have you seen much of the, like, because we've known, you know, we talk about Hasbro all the time and Israel's how good they've been at misinformation and disinformation for years. Have you seen a change in that since October 7th and how the truth now seems to break through with in the digital realm, even as social media, you know, becomes slightly more toxic in many ways, there is also information getting out there that wouldn't do through the traditional means.
Right. So there's obviously been a lot more success and exposure of the content that I produce. But on a larger scale, there's the production of this content all over the world and on all platforms. You can really like actively witness the younger generations in the US and across the world becoming more informed and their literacy around certain issues, including the intricacies of boycotts and things of that nature, just advancing all the time. I remember I got TikTok kind of around the start of the war or around the start of the genocide. And I just remember thinking, how does it already have like this perfect algorithm curated for me where it's all Palestine content? And then I think it was a couple weeks later, TikTok had to release a press release that said practically TikTok's algorithm isn't pro-Palestine, young people are. They had to defend themselves because Zionist groups and right-wing American politicians were accusing it of Palestinian propaganda. And so they had to say, no, that's just the majority of content on our platform.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Zarifa. You know, here in Washington, D.C., there is just this massive campaign, you know, that is mainly the Republicans, but also the vast majority of the Democrats against TikTok. And they say, you know, like TikTok, which is, of course, run by the Chinese government, as they claim, you know, it's knowingly spreading this pro-Palestinian propaganda. And I'm like, have these guys looked at Instagram recently? Have these guys looked at X recently? You know, the digital world is full of pro-Palestinian posts and posts that are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And that's not anything to do with algorithms. It's to do with the global public suddenly having a voice. So, you know, they want to abolish or force a sale, you know, at very low cost of TikTok, mainly as an anti-China move. But they're trying to use this like, oh my goodness, you know, it's full of pro-Palestinian stuff. I just want to come back to Tony and to the tagline on our Palcast here, which is One World, One Struggle, that Tony got permission for us to use for the Palcast. And I think today, more than ever, we see One World, One Struggle, which is so moving.
Can I be really cheeky and say the Bloody Sunday families in the Free Derry Museum, who used that tagline for all the years they were seeking justice, there was a famous case with the Birmingham Six where men were elite, were imprisoned for a crime they did not commit in the UK. And when they emerged from the prison, the tricolour that was carried only today was handed over to the Free Derry Museum. So there's a little bit of nostalgia and a little bit of history for everybody. So sorry, I always have to have that little Irish gem in here in each episode. So apologies for my self-indulgence, but I just thought it was lovely.
No, yeah, that is. Wow.
Yusuf, can I ask you, if you don't mind, because I think we need to talk a little bit about what's actually happening right now on the ground and the idea that the ICC, that there's a lot of problems because apparently, and Zarif, would be fascinated to get your input on this, that the main pressure is the US trying to say, please don't issue an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu. It seems crazy to me that this is where what seems to be happening behind the scenes.
I mean, if you look at the case of the ICC and Russia and the ICC and Palestine, you understand how the U.S. operates in world politics. So it's not about human rights. It's about U.S. adversaries. And in this case, it's not Russia, it's Israel. So they will try to pressure the ICC not to issue these warrants against Netanyahu because there are credible news reports that this is the case, and Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders and politicians might face arrest. In fact, Israel's foreign minister said that if these warrants are issued, then Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders will not travel outside Israel. So there is a serious political but also legitimacy threat to these, you know, Israeli politicians who engaged in a genocide in Gaza. And of course, the U.S. is there, the same as they provided diplomatic and political cover for Israel at the U.N. Security Council, using the veto multiple times to prevent resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. They will continue to protect Israeli politicians, including Netanyahu. You know, if you watch liberal American media, you think, oh, there is like a huge difference, or like there is a gap in understanding and approach between Biden and Netanyahu. But in reality, the U.S. is the U.S. and Israel is Israel, and they're protecting, you know, the U.S. is protecting Israel. As Palestinians, we never thought of the U.S. as an honest broker for peace. We knew that the U.S. has been there to give Israel more time so that Israel would expand more at our expense. So this is our belief. And we don't think that the U.S. will change anytime soon.
Zarif, have you got any thoughts on that, especially from the viewpoint of sitting in Seattle now and seeing what's happening in terms of, as one of my friends, an economist in Colorado, refers to your presidential choices as the sleeper versus the creeper. So unfortunate as that is, but that's where we are.
Sleepy Joe, yeah. Yeah, American democracy is thriving. I mean, I think in regards to the ICC case and these rumors about arrest warrants for Netanyahu, I think if the last 6 months have really taught us anything, it's just a confirmation that the application of international law is always political. Even recently, like in the American context, I think it was just yesterday? Over 90 lawyers, including over 20 from within the Biden administration itself, wrote a legal letter kind of claiming that the U.S. was not only in violation of international law, but in violation of U.S. law, and pushed them to sanction Israel or to cut off further weaponry sales. I mean, as of now, we provide Israel with $3.8 billion a day. And last week, Congress just approved another $26.3 billion, the majority of which is going to replenishing missiles and their rocket defense systems. And just a mere $9 billion for so-called humanitarian purposes. Who knows if it will even enter. And also, they've destroyed the infrastructure of UNRWA to some extent by defunding UNRWA. So it's really all in vain allocating any of that to humanitarian purposes, especially when the vast majority of that money would be going to missiles, and then a crumb of it would be going to feed the people that survived those missiles. But this, I mean, we're seeing slight deviations with the Biden administration from at least the way that the U.S. has historically dealt with Israel. There's never been consequences for Israel. There's hardly ever been real investigations, at least under the Leahy laws, which a lot of people are revoking right now. I think the only time the Leahy laws was actually ever kind of implemented or investigated was in Lebanon, during Israel's assault on Lebanon. In, was it 2006? Was it 2006?
It was.
Yeah.
I think kind of historically speaking, I don't think that the U.S. government is ever going to make a decision based off any kind of moral code. They've always been a violent, repressive, settler colonial state, just as Israel is. So there really is no logical reason for them to for some reason to take a stand against Israel when it's perpetrated these crimes itself and engaged in these crimes alongside Israel for decades and decades. But I think the only thing that would really trigger that shift is the continuation of protests and political pressure from within the U.S. and outside of the U.S.
That's right. Today I came across a letter that was signed by more than 100 NGOs in the U.S. calling for the on the Biden administration to resume funds to UNRWA. But as we know, Zarifa, that it's not only bombs and, you know, aid that impact Palestinians. There are stories that people outside Gaza, those who did not visit Gaza or have connections to Gaza, can barely understand. And we have the issue of over 10,000 Palestinians who are either killed or went missing. So their fate is unknown. They're either captured, killed, or, you know, they're resting in a mass grave we do not know about, and or under the rubble of their homes. And recently there have been more efforts across the Gaza Strip to uncover the bodies of Palestinians from mass graves, such as what happened at Shifa Hospital, Nasser Medical Complex, but also from under the rubble of their own homes. And I know that you have a story, you have a family story of one of your uncles, Dr. Hamdi Shaat, who went missing in January. Could you please share with us what happened and what is the latest on that?
Yeah, so my uncle Hamdi, he is was the dean of the law school at Al-Azhar in Gaza, very intelligent, prominent figure in Gaza. And yeah, it was in late January during a military incursion that he went missing in Khan Yunis. And since then, his location has been unknown. And I think that that's kind of that not knowing, along with thousands of other Palestinian families that are dealing with that torment, it's terrorizing in itself that, you don't know if they're at rest. You don't know if they're at peace. You don't know if they're in one of these mass graves. You don't know if they're being tortured in a detention camp. But all that you know is that they've suffered, that he's without his medication. When I was there just 2 years ago, he could hardly walk because of his medical condition. And so the fact that that was taken advantage of by the Israeli forces, that he couldn't run away like the younger people in that situation. Yeah, and that's the story of every family member that's found one of their relatives at the Nasser Hospital or the Shifa Hospital. They'd been also waiting those months to uncover the truth about where their loved ones are.
Yeah, I think the mass graves story over the past couple of weeks has been huge. And of course, in this country, in the United States, it's been to some extent overtaken by the story of the protests here, which is an important story. But of course, the way it gets told in the mainstream corporate media is, oh my goodness, all these Jewish students are feeling insecure, you know, because of the Palestinian flags and Palestinian slogans and people calling for a ceasefire and people shouting out against Zionism. So there's a, you know, in spite of that misinformation and Hasbara that is poured into the mainstream media, the young people have been doing a great job, very, very well organized and great discipline. And when the Zionist provocateurs go and try and provoke them from the edge of the protest, they just turn their back, you know, and ignore them, which, of course, the Zionist provocateurs hate being ignored. More than anything, they hate being ignored. But, right. You know, I think the mass grave story is something that people really need to, you know, think about very deeply because as you and Yusuf have so beautifully described it, you know, that's an ongoing bleeding wound for all of you who have family in Gaza, you know, not knowing. And I saw a news report, some like organization saying that the rubble in Gaza contains so many unexploded munitions that it's going to be like take more than a decade to get rid of the unexploded munitions. And they didn't even mention that it's also full of decayed and decaying body parts of your and Yusuf's relatives and friends. So, you know, I think we need to sit with that, just the loss and the hurt and not to let it like just make you totally depressed. I have so much admiration for people like you, Zarifa, and you, Yusuf, who are having to put up with all this hurt and loss and uncertainty and grief. But you're out there and you are connecting and you are building hope for your own futures back home in Gaza, back home in Palestine, and for the generations to come. So, you know, I just have so much admiration for you.
Thank you. That's so sweet. That means a lot.
You know, also, I want to conclude with the fact that this rubble that contains the bodies of our beloved ones, you know, the decomposing bodies of our families and friends, is also used to build a seaport in Gaza that we do not need. We already have one that was destroyed by Israel. I would like to thank Zarifa Baroud for joining us today from Seattle. Thank you for the conversation and sharing all these stories, personal stories, very touching from Gaza. But also for your insights into what's happening in the U.S. and Palestine and the student encampments. Thank you very much for joining us, Zarifa.
Of course. Thank you so much.
I would like to thank our co-sponsors, the Hashim Sani for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya. Thank you to co-my hosts, Helena and Tony. See you next week.
I must die, you must live, to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, making a kind.